News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Why do we punish? It's a debate people likely have had from the very start of communal living, in tribes, in villages, in giant cities, and yet we're still conflicted about why we do it. Sometimes we punish for retribution, like the Old Testament advises, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Sometimes it's because we want to incapacitate wrongdoers, to lock them up so they can't cause any more trouble. Sometimes we punish with a wider goal of deterrence. By making those who commit crimes suffer, we send a broader message to everyone in society: don't even think about it. And sometimes we punish in the hope of rehabilitation, that the punishment itself will help offenders recognize the error of their ways and reform them. But each of these views raises many questions. For example, if punishment deterred crime, why are our jails and prisons so full? If we feel locking a criminal away ensures public safety, how long do we lock them away? And if punishment is about justice for victims, who gets to decide what that justice should look like, the courts or the victim himself? Today, it's our monthly philosophy series, The Socrates Exchange Returns, and the question we're asking this hour is, why do we punish? Let's hear from you. Our number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Again, 1-800-892-6477. The Socrates Exchange is funded in part by the New Hampshire Humanities Council. Our philosopher this month is Max Latona. Max is an associate professor of philosophy at St. Anselm College, and Max, always nice to see you. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you, Laura. And once again, it's a pleasure.
Well, just what are some of the central philosophical questions, Max, that come up as we look at this question of why do we punish? This is a hefty topic.
Well, as always, you frame the issue, I think, quite well. What can I add? Well, it seems to me we should probably agree on what punishment is before we start talking about why we do it. And we can agree, I think, on at least three things. First, it involves some infliction of suffering or deprivation by a legitimate authority upon someone who has performed some transgression or wrongdoing. And it's the issue of the suffering or deprivation that we're imposing that I think raises the most questions. Why do we do that? Is it because of something good that we hope will happen as a result of the punishment, that is to say in the future, such as deterrence, as you mentioned, or preventing the same person from doing the action in the future, or even rehabilitating the person so that they're a productive member of society? Or, on the other hand, is it because of something that has happened, past tense, that is to say something that the criminal the accused has done in the past that we're responding to? And if so, in what way are we responding to it, and how is punishment an adequate response? So a good test case for our listeners to think about as they chew on this problem is the current case of John Demjanjuk in Munich. There's a trial underway right now in which Demjanjuk is the accused killer, a Nazi killer in the death camps, and he's responsible arguably for the death of some 28,000 Jews. And the question is, what are we doing when we're putting him on trial and possibly punishing him? He's 90 years old. There's muttering about leukemia, heart attacks, and so on. He appeared in a hospital gurney in one moment of the trial. Is it worthwhile to punish him, given the fact that there's arguably no deterrence going to happen here?
He's not going to do the same thing
again. He's not
going
to do it. Yeah, exactly. Is it still important to punish him? And if so, why? So that's something for people to think about as we get into this.
Wow. Well, again, the number here in the Socrates Exchange is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Give us your thoughts. As Max said, what is punishment? What is the purpose? Why do we do it? Do we think it will create a better outcome, like perhaps rehabilitation? 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. And Max, our listeners are already ready to get Socratic with us, so let's go to them now. And Aaron's calling from Alton Bay. Hi, Aaron. Go ahead. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Laura. Hi, Max. Thanks.
What are your thoughts, Aaron, on this question, why do we punish?
Well, I think I would just like to place it in more of an inverse way, which would be, why do we reward? Because I think there are different sides of the same coin. And what is our real true motivations behind why we punish or why we reward, why we give carrots and sticks, you know, so to speak. And really, I'd say, from the way I see it, is it's just really our desire to manipulate people.
Oh,
and
wow.
Why do we want to manipulate people to do this or to not do that? That's really kind of what I'm postulating.
Wow. Okay, so it's a form of social control or behavioral modification. Aaron, let me ask you this.
Sure.
When we hold a race and we have 10 people running the race, one person gets the prize at the end, namely the person who runs faster than everyone else, despite the fact that we might not like that person or we might have more sympathy for someone else. We think that that person in some way or other deserves the prize, given the conditions of the race and that they ran it faster than everybody else. And by the same token, we use that same language when we say, well, you know, and so deserves to spend 10 years in prison for a given transgression. Isn't there something going on more than simply carrots and sticks there, that we are responding to what the person has done in such a way that we think they're owed the reward or owed the punishment? What do you think about that?
Well, I'd say that, you know, it's kind of an interesting analogy you brought up with the race example. And I would say that, well, why are you competing in the race, and why are you deciding to take certain actions depending upon what the activity is? And obviously in the case of, you know, I guess the most egregious would be if somebody murders somebody, then obviously we feel like we need to take some sort of, you know, punitive or real, you know, harsh action toward it.
Right.
But, you know, running a race and giving somebody first prize is certainly, I think, far different than, you know, deciding to put somebody behind bars because they murdered somebody.
Well, yeah, no question. But in both cases, we use the word deserves or deserts.
Right.
And I guess my point would simply be that, we might want to deter other people from doing this sorts of thing, you know, the crime that the accused committed. But at the same time, we think that even beyond that, that there's a sense in which they deserve the punishment that they're getting. Or perhaps that's meaningless language. I mean, maybe you're arguing that's simply an emotive response, an attempt to harm someone for what they've done to us.
Well, I think there's definitely emotive responses, without a doubt, especially, you know, if somebody, for instance, you know, murdered my wife, I can't imagine that I would not have an emotive response and you know, talk about, well, that person deserves something. I would certainly have an emotion behind it.
Right.
But, you know, being in touch with that and really, you know, framing it in that way, like, okay, this is an emotive response. It's, you know, but does that really mean that what this person's getting what they deserve?
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Aaron, thanks for kicking it off today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, no worries. Thanks.
Bye-bye. Again, it's the Socrates Exchange today on The Exchange. Our number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. The question we're examining this hour with Max Latona is, why do we punish? Do we punish because it makes us feel morally superior? Does punishment dehumanize the offender? What do we mean by punishment? What is the goal when we punish? Our number, 1-800-892-6477. And just a reminder that this is a different conversation from a regular exchange program. Max's role here is not to answer the question. It's to explore it with you through the Socratic method of asking more questions. So when you call in, stay on the line with us for a while and we'll have a dialogue. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. Max, let's go to Martin in Concord. Hi, Martin, you're on the Socrates Exchange. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks, Laura. I appreciate you taking my call. I would just like to kind of express my opinion, really, on this. And I'm thinking about the question from from a legal standpoint, in terms of, you know, what we do as a legal society, as that sort of government entities. And my opinion is that the purpose of punishment really ought to be twofold. You know, one is there has to be an element of deterrence involved, meaning it has to be such that it convinces other people not to do, you know, similar acts. And at the very least, the person who's involved has to convince them that the, you know, their idea of what the risk equation was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Although I think if we don't simultaneously apply some element of rehabilitation, then we miss an opportunity to correct an underlying problem. And the odds of, you know, recidivism and all those other societal problems it seem to be greatly enhanced.
Well, hold on, Martin. Stay on the line and go ahead, Max.
Well, I think those are excellent points. I'd have to agree, I think, that the deterrence is an important element. Otherwise, our laws would have no teeth, right? They'd be merely suggestions. please don't
speed
over
60. We urge you to do this.
Yeah, right. I guess the rehabilitation is important, too. I like the way he put that. We're missing an opportunity if we don't try to do that. But I guess like with the previous caller, I'm wondering if we're overlooking something when we're not talking about just desserts in some way or other. What would you think about that, Martin? Do you think that's a third component or not? That there's a sense in which punishment is deserved.
Yeah, I mean, I think that actually is one of the things that makes it very difficult for us to come to agreement on what are the right sorts of punishment and what because we don't all agree. I think from an emotional standpoint, that's important. People want to feel that someone got what they deserved. Although from a societal standpoint, I think that involving that in the in the calculation about the death penalty and mandatory sentencing and things of that. First of all, I think it's a significant point of disagreement among people.
Yeah, sure.
What should be the objective? And I think it causes us to do things that undermine, at the very least, the rehabilitation aspect, and if not the also the deterrence aspect.
Well, let me give you a counterexample here. Suppose we were to if deterrence was our primary or aim in punishing, then couldn't you argue that the more severe the penalty, the better? That is to say, much like Draco did in ancient Athens, we should make a death penalty for all crimes, in which case nobody would commit any crimes. That is to say, the more severe the penalty, the better. And if you say no, isn't it because you think that it's somehow unfair? It goes beyond what is deserved by the person in question.
Well, yeah, and I'm not trying to make an argument for for the rightness or wrongness of death penalty. So I mean, I agree that if deterrence is an objective, then the more severe the punishment, the more the deterrence.
And Martin, I'm going to have to let you go, and I sure appreciate you joining us. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Martin.
And the number for you to get Socratic is 1-800-892-6477. We'll be back in just a minute.
Good morning, it's 9:19, and support for NHPR comes from you, our members. Support also comes to us from Gripponi Auto Group, featuring multiple lines of fuel-efficient, environmentally friendly cars at Gripponi Auto Junction in Bow, and online 24 hours a day at gripponi.com. From Clean Yield, Norwich and Greensboro, Vermont, tailoring investment portfolios that reflect each client's financial goals and social values. Information at cleanyield.com. And Concord Regional Visiting Nurse Association presenting Passion for Caring, a community event to benefit hospice on May 4th at Company C in Concord. Details at crvna.org. More of the Socrates Exchange on NHPR at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show. It's the Friday News Roundup. New Hampshire weather today, sunny and cooler, with highs from around 40 northern parts of the state, upper 40s to lower 50s for the rest of the state. Clear tonight, lows teens north, lower 20s central parts of the state, upper 20s in the south. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, it's our Socrates Exchange, where once a month we examine one question using the Socratic method of asking more questions. And this month, that question is, why do we punish? Here's some of the questions that we've been looking at. What is punishment all about? Is it to deter us from harming others? How do our religious traditions teach us about punishment? What's the difference between punishment and revenge? Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Max Latona is my co-host today, Associate Professor of Philosophy at St. Anselm College. And Max, let's go to Keene now. And Peter calls us from there. Hi, Peter. Your thoughts on this question. Why do we punish?
Yes, I had a few points. One, I was wondering, when do we actually realize someone has been rehabilitated since we're actually putting this on the record for life? You know, if it's about correcting behavior and we feel that we've actually have rehabilitated someone, but yet they're now stigmatized for life.
Yeah, okay. So what's your question?
My question is, how do we know when someone has been rehabilitated?
Oh, that's a good question. What would you say?
I would say that, I was always growing up, once you serve your time, once you've served your time.
Yeah.
Well, everyone's given a second chance. open society that isn't how our society isn't set up.
And Peter, just a reminder, Max is a philosopher, not a criminal justice expert, so we're kind of teasing out the question.
Oh, that's all right, but it's a fair question. I think the simple answer would be that if they don't do the same thing again, then we've succeeded in somehow rehabilitating them, wouldn't you say?
Right. I would. But as a society, they're still stigmatized. As our society, we actually force people, you know, they're now labeled for life. This is on the criminal record for life. They now have to put this on job applications for life.
Yeah. Yeah. So in other words, the punishment continues even after their so-called sentence is up, right?
Their rehabilitation, regardless if it was a drug crime or whatever. You know, if they've been rehabilitated, first offense, they're now stigmatized for life. They're now on the, you know, there's now state welfare, food stamps, all that type of stuff, ineligible for all that.
Yeah. Well, so you seem to assume, though, that the primary purpose of punishment is to rehabilitate. Is that what you're saying?
Having had spent some time in jail, I'd have to say that the deterrent of jail actually ends in the first week. Once you acclimate to being in jail, you're basically just hanging out. You're now at home. It's so comfortable in jail these days with cable television and, you know, your TV on all the time. You know, recreation.
Well, that's an interesting remark.
Hey, Peter, can I ask you a question? And I'm so glad you called. We did a show on, I can't remember exactly what it was, but something having to do with criminal justice and rehabilitation. And someone called in and said that he had been in and out of jail. It was recidivism. That was it. How to keep people from returning. He said he'd been in and out of jail 3 times. Nothing anyone could do, programs, discussions, religious help, nothing anyone did inside those 4 walls helped him until he decided himself that he didn't want to commit crime anymore. So what does that say to you? Does that say punishment doesn't rehabilitate, or it only works when some sort of light goes off, or what?
Well, it goes to show that jail isn't a deterrent, because most people committing crimes aren't thinking about what's the overhead, the sentence that's hanging over them if they commit it. And people that have been to jail already realize it's not as scary as the rest of society believes it is.
Right. So from what I understand, though, people who have been incarcerated say one of the worst things that they experience is this sense of lost time, the sense of the meaninglessness of this just sitting in jail and not doing anything productive. And I'm wondering,
it's the most boring place on the planet.
Yeah.
Even with the cable TV,
I'm wondering now, do you think it would be important, given your experience and your thoughts on the matter, for us to give people who have done something wrong an opportunity to so-called pay back society for what they've done, rather than simply languishing in inactivity? What do you think?
I would agree, because I know people who get out who are now going on Social Security, who are going on food, because basically, instead of bettering themselves, they're coming back and we're spending all this money and resources to get them back on their feet. And at some level, they're never probably able to get to where they could have without that label.
Yeah. So do you think we should punish in a different way than we currently are?
I think for different crimes have different directions. You know, I mean, violent crimes one way, sex offenders one way, drug offenses, you know, the same cookie-cutter approach to everyone.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, there are programs you can do on your own inside.
Yeah.
But there's not, like, a certain program, like, these people should be working on these steps to get out.
Okay.
Peter, thanks.
So the crime should fit the punishment in some way or other. Okay, good. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter, for getting Socratic with us. I really appreciate it.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Our number on the Socrates Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. The question we're pondering this hour with you is, why do we punish? Now, for more on this question, we talked with Stephen Reno. You may know him as Executive Director of Leadership New Hampshire or as the former chancellor of our university system. But Reno has taught comparative religion for 40 years. Our executive producer, Keith Shields, caught up with him.
I think that theories of punishment are based upon a recognition of the fallibility of human beings, the tendency of human beings to not quite be as good or perfect as they might be. It's interesting, the Greek word for sin is hamartian, which means to miss the mark. So if you imagine someone shooting a bow and arrow, to miss the mark is hamartian. And so the very idea of sin suggests that there's a goal, a norm, a target that we are supposed to meet, to hit, to conform to. But human beings being what we are, we don't always do it. So a notion of correcting that would be to say, oops, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done that. But there's a more fundamental understanding of human beings that seems to suggest that just the act of saying sorry isn't enough, and that you need to have some sort of an experience that lets you know that you shouldn't do this again. And it seems that the best way for us to be taught that lesson is to make us uncomfortable in some way, to punish, whether it is a slap on the wrist, a spank on the rear end, putting you in stocks in the marketplace, wearing a scarlet letter, or putting you in jail. The word punishment actually is based on the Latin word pena, which means pain or suffering. So ultimately, there seems to be a kind of fundamental recognition that the way you get someone's attention and help them not to do something again is to do something to them that is painful, hurtful, embarrassing, and ultimately memorable, and that at the end of the day, real repentance comes only after a person has had an experience of that kind. The notion of punishment and this sort of an understanding of human nature does seem to underlie most religious traditions. In Hebrew, the word repentance is teshuvah, which suggests that it's something that has to come from the heart. In Arabic, the word is tauba, and the word there means returning. In both cases, it suggests that there's a norm that one must return to, conform to, and in the latter, the case of Allah, to return to the Sharia, to the law. And if it's going to be real, it's got to have a cost to it. Think about the fact that we value those things that are valuable. So if someone says, "I'm sorry," well, those are words that we conventionally take to mean, "I know I did something I shouldn't have done to you, and I regret it." If someone says, "I'm sorry, and I want to take you out to lunch," or "I'm sorry, I want to give you $1,000, or if the person who says, "I'm sorry," is a very, very important person and they somewhat humble themselves, all of those are ways that value gets added to the gesture of recognition of fault. So punishment often means that what you do to express a change, that "I won't do this again," has value because something has been invested in it, whether it be something you are willingly giving up or something you've been deprived of. One understanding of the way in which an offense can be addressed or corrected or rectified can be to try to find an equal measure of punishment. A classic form, of course, from the Bible is an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Because then I can truly empathize with you because I am suffering just exactly as you suffered. In the Christian gospel, we get a quite different view. Jesus admonishes or instructs his followers to turn the other cheek. That absolutely runs contrary to the eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. And what it does, one could argue, is that it elevates the response above the ordinary human expectation of equal retribution for an offense to a very unhuman response, which is to forgive a person. And that is precisely what the message of the gospel, according to religious traditions, would say. And that is that, no, you don't behave as a normal human being would behave. You behave as a Christian would behave. I think that all forms of punishment have an element of reformation. And again, the very word reformation is to reform. Think of the word repent, which has the experience of being deprived. All of these are experiences that ultimately have as their outcome making us a better person. It's interesting to observe those people in the spiritual life who, by all of our judgments, have never committed any sin, never committed any infraction. They're good people. And yet they discipline themselves because they are still trying to reform themselves to be better. Why do Buddhist monks and nuns take a vow of celibacy, a vow of poverty, a vow of obedience, as do many Christian religious? It's not to make up for necessarily the sins of the past, but rather to reform themselves in some way that is better, that is more spiritual.
That conversation with Leadership New Hampshire Executive Director and Comparative Religion Scholar Stephen Reno was produced by Exchange Executive Producer Keith Shields. Our number for you to join us on the Socrates Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. What do you think of this question? Why do we punish? Let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. And Max, let's go right back to our callers. John is waiting in Warner. John, good morning. Your thoughts on this question. Why do we punish?
I think you've got it backwards. Pain was invented long before humans to avoid bad behavior. Bad being anything damaging to the animal himself, including us. Okay, there's not actually any pain nerves. Your brain has to make pain out of the total sensation that's coming into your body. And that is punishment. Now, people try to punish each other because people want to make them do what they want them to do, but they're trying to mimic what nature invented a long time ago.
So punishment is about inflicting pain. Yes?
That's the only true punishment that nature supplies. Human beings invent all kinds of interesting manipulations of that. But like the guy that was in jail, you know, jail's not a punishment. So we said, oh, well, we can't beat people. We can't whip them anymore because that's inhumane. So we do something silly. So then we wonder why there's such a recidivism.
So are you advocating that we have more pain in our forms of punishment? Is that what you're suggesting?
Not really. Your question is, why do we punish?
Right. And what's your answer?
We punish because we're trying to make other people do what we want them to do.
So it's a form of social control.
It's a form of social control, right.
So go ahead.
And the only effective way in the long run, okay, is with pain. Now, because humans are complex, you can succeed in lesser punishments. I mean, you don't have to crush somebody's hand because they stole a candy bar. Maybe you can slap their wrist. I'm not judging that.
Yeah. So, but going back to what Stephen Reno said in his thoughtful remarks a moment ago, could we argue that such pain has a more ulterior purpose or motive, namely to teach the person not to do that again, or to teach them why what they did was wrong and how they ought to act? What would you say to that?
Yeah, that's what pain is about. It's a teaching tool that was invented a long, long time before humans.
Okay. So the primary purpose of punishment is to teach or rehabilitate then.
Very good.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you, John.
Thank you very much, John, for joining us. And our number, 1-800-892-6477. Again, it's the Socrates Exchange. And the question we're pondering this month with Max Latona is, why do we punish? Let's go, Max, next to Philip, waiting in Hancock. Hi, Philip, your thoughts on why do we punish? What do you think?
Hi. As a recovering alcoholic, I've found that resentment is a huge thing that can kill me. I harbor resentments, and in every day, if somebody does something that I feel is negative towards me, you know, a crime, so to speak, can be small, I feel like I need to get back at them in order to sort of win, and this really destroys me, and I kind of see society as a whole as like that, you know, somebody commits a crime, we have to show them that they didn't win top them.
Uh-huh.
But I know that it kills me, and it can, you know, kind of hurt society at the same time.
Ah, okay. So punishment is a sort of state-sanctioned vengeance.
Exactly.
So then you seem to be suggesting we should forgive all the people who have done wrong, our murderers and rapists and thieves and so on?
Now, so, yeah, that's what I was thinking. Not necessarily, and it's a tough situation, but I do see, you know, maybe lesser crimes. You know, I'm not here to say one way or another, but
yeah.
I think it was a very interesting thing to have me start thinking about because, you know, all I know is what I know, and to all of a sudden see something differently,
yeah.
You know, just created more questions.
Well, Yeah, and I think you raise a good point. I mean, there is something about forgiveness that helps us, the person who has been victimized by some crime, to move on in life, right? And if we're burdened by this anger and hatred, then in a sense we've suffered double injury. But at the same time, we might ask, does the person deserve such forgiveness, right? I mean, if they're an unrepentant criminal, it might do us good to forgive them. But on the other hand, it seems to be unfair or unjust to simply forgive them without any good reason for doing so. What do you think?
Yeah, that's true. You know, it's like I said, I don't really have the answers, but I know that a lot of times the people that do something, they're hurting just as much, if not more.
Okay. So sometimes they deserve forgiveness as well.
Yeah, and maybe they'll see something. But in turn, you know, if a murderer, who know, you know, I can't tell you. It might just go out and do it again.
Well, Philip, let me jump in if I could. You know, certainly there's a lot to say for forgiveness on the personal level, but once you reach the societal level, does the state, does the society, does the judicial system have a role in, you know, it's fine for you to forgive, but have a role in protecting people, keeping people from doing things that they shouldn't do? What do you think?
Yeah, they do. I mean, that is their role, I suppose. It seems though, you know, with law enforcement and all, that it's kind of disconnected from the whole human aspect, which, you know, it's been brought up that we're very complex creatures. And so just having a structure that says, you know, just know and here's your consequence, without looking at the personal level. And I know it costs lots of money to have individual cases and whatnot, but I guess I was just bringing up that it is a very complex thing.
Right. And you're right. You know, there is perhaps an element of forgiveness even in this broader system because, you know, sometimes you'll hear someone say, this criminal had a terrible life, he was abused as a child or whatever. So, Philip, thank you so much for adding to our discussion today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Again, our number on the Socrates Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Max, let's go to the break with a posting from Pete who says, we punish for wrongdoing to uphold a trust in our institutions. When enforcement of laws break down, we can no longer trust our currency, stores, banks, or government. More on the Socrates Exchange coming up.
This is Carl Castle. Join me.
Wait. NPR legend Carl Castle?
Well, I wouldn't say that.
The man of 3,000 voicemail messages? That Carl Castle?
Roughly 3,000. Might have been a little more or a little less.
The official judge and scorekeeper for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me? What are you doing?
Well, I'll be in Nashua June 6th talking with NHPR's Laura Kanoy. So please visit nhpr.org for tickets and information.
Can I have your autograph?
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from New England College, accepting applications for the School Climate Leadership Program, preparing educators to become national leaders in building respectful schools. Information at nec.edu. And Sky Meadow Country Club in Nashua, a full-service private country club, hosting weddings, corporate meetings, banquets, and golf events. Accepting membership applications, skymeadow.com. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Monday in The Exchange, a look at John Carroll's new book, The Real Dirt, on why New England is the least food-independent region in the country and his prescription to change that. Email us your questions and comments before the program at nhpr.org and join us Monday morning live at 9. Today, it's The Socrates Exchange. Max Latona is here, and this month we're pondering the question, why do we punish? Max, let's go right back to our callers. Steve's calling in from Keene. Hi, Steve, you're on the air. What do you think of the question? Why do we punish?
Good morning, Laura. Good morning, Max.
Good morning, Steve.
Well, one observation I had is that a lot of things you're discussing are not mutually exclusive hypotheses. So
Right. Maybe
the idea of a single cause for punishment is a little bit wrong-headed.
Mm-hmm.
But I have yet another hypothesis to throw into the mix.
All right.
And that is, we haven't really talked about punishment on a societal level being motivated by profit. And my point has two aspects. One is that jails and prisons several generations ago were almost entirely run by the state. And now we have one of the most rapidly expanding areas of our economy is the prison industrial complex.
Mm-hmm.
And this leads to both legal and illegal pressure to increase the number of people behind bars, the number of people being punished. And legally, lobbying, there's pressure actually for harsher sentences, longer sentences. And I'm sure you're aware of that case out of Pennsylvania a couple of years ago, a story that was first broken by the New York Times, in which two Pennsylvania judges were convicted of taking kickbacks from the prison industry.
Yeah.
Specifically, it was a juvenile jail, and one judge took kickbacks to make sure that when it was time to replace the existing jail, he said, let's outsource and have a private jail.
Mm-hmm.
And the other judge was convicted for giving jail time for offenses that normally would just get a finger wagging. I think the most egregious example I recall is when two children got into a fight at recess at school, and one was given 9 months in the juvenile detention facility.
Yikes.
But there's a second aspect of this profit motive,
mm-hmm.
And that is our system, our economic system, also requires cheap labor, and we do that either by fighting unions or by going for sweatshops overseas. But prison labor is a growing sector, and many corporations, including Victoria's Secret and Russell Athletic, have a portion of their clothes sewn in prison by prison laborers who make, at the most, 65 cents an hour. In some cases, they don't make anything.
Yeah. Wow.
So punishment is all about profit, Steve.
Well, again, my comment about not being mutually exclusive, but in part, profit is a motivation.
Yeah. Certainly, I mean, that would raise these are serious concerns about what we're doing, especially with the privatization of the prison industry. But I'm wondering, this raises questions about unjust forms of punishment, whether it be putting people in prison who don't deserve to be there because of some profit that is accruing to the magistrates involved, or perhaps having them do something like making clothes and whatnot that is somehow unfair to ask them to do. But, I mean, we can still ask, right, that there are certain forms of punishment that are just, right? And you would have to agree to that.
Oh, I would totally concur.
Yeah.
I sort of see this as a modifying consideration, not a fundamental explanation for our need to punish, either societally or individually.
So let's just go back. I mean, do you think that the primary purpose of punishment is to deter, as most of our callers seem to have suggested?
Well, I actually, as it is actually practiced, as opposed to theory, I am more inclined to say that what we observe fits with the idea that punishment is for some sense of societal vengeance.
Wow.
And that's pessimistic, but I think it fits the facts.
Yeah.
And there is, if you will, if you think about this, sort of like how we view prisoners, we do see them as less human. I mean, another thing we do to prisoners is it is one of the few areas where you can still be a subject in medical research, for example, without your permission.
So, Steve, if it's all about vengeance, there's no value to it at all?
Well, it depends. It has to be located in time and in place. If you look at other correctional systems around the world, you see some that are really focused on rehabilitation. But I don't think ours is one of those. I think we're definitely an eye for an eye kind of society.
Okay, so you use that word correctional. Let me ask a question. Let's suppose that someone has done something very wrong to some innocent members of society. We put them on trial. We convict them. And we spend now the next 10 or 20 years using our resources as a society to make them better persons, that is to say, to rehabilitate them. That might mean vocational training. That might mean education in a classroom. It might mean therapies, psychological sessions, and so on. And in the end, they come out better persons than they were when they went in. Isn't there something unfair about that? That having done something wrong to society, now society uses its resources to, in fact, better or help that person when, in fact, perhaps those resources should be used to compensate the victim or something along those lines. Why is it that we're...
If I were going to be utilitarian about it, I would say that ultimately if we could rehabilitate offenders, it costs us less money. So it's actually in society's advantage to rehabilitate.
Okay, good point.
But I think your original premise has to be qualified. You said when an offender does something wrong, and then you listed the sequelae.
Yeah.
I think what we have to start with is asking, you know, what is the race of the offender and what is their crime? Because we have definitely different tracks in this country, depending for, say, white collar, white as in race, and white collar as in profession criminals versus blue collar people of color.
Unfortunately,
all right. Well, Steve, thank
true.
You
yeah.
very much for
thank
being
you,
with
Steven.
Us. Thanks a lot.
All right. Bye bye.
Yep.
And let's take another call, Max. This is Kim in Webster. Hi, Kim. You're on the Socrates Exchange. Thanks for being with us. What do you think of the question?
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning.
Essentially, I look at it from a very basic level of essentially the punishment in regards to punishment. It's the consequence of behavior, and be that on any level, whether we're relating that to the animal kingdom, which essentially is just a bit lower on the food chain below human development. When we watch animals on a day-to-day basis, essentially if in fact an infraction of behavior and acceptable behavior has been done in the herd, mm-hmm. the consequence meets that behavior. If in fact we watch animals go over and per se take a little bit of my food within my space, the consequence is immediate. In other words, you'll see either a bite or a kick happen. It's over, it's done with, and essentially the consequence has met the behavior. And then it's released. There is no forgiveness. And I understand on a conscious level, maybe that may be simpler in regards to animals, whereas humans are a bit more conscious of their behavior. But there needs to be accountability. And in that aspect, whereas we take and we watch animals, the accountability is instantaneous. There is no time.
Yeah, there's something both comforting and disturbing about what you're saying. I guess the disturbing part is that for all of the theories we've got out there in punishment and the elaborate explanations as to why we're punishing, you're saying they're simply just dress up for an instinctual response of the herd, the
Absolutely.
Human herd. And well, that it's disturbing, I guess, for I'm sure legal theorists, because they'd like to think that there's sound reasons that they're articulating. But I guess there is something comforting about it in the sense that what you're suggesting is that punishment has its primary purpose, almost restitution for the individual back into the community. That is to say, they've done something that is injurious or at least bothersome to the community. The community reacts by inflicting some kind of harm, and then they accept that member of the herd back into their community, and they move on.
Absolutely.
And I think that there is some support for that out there. That when we punish someone, they've done their time. We can say now we accept you back into the community. Unfortunately, as one of our earlier callers pointed out, some people can never live down their criminal record. That's a disturbing component to it. But I think that's an important consideration. We're accepting them back into the community. They've been restored, and now we can move on and forget what they've done.
Kim, thanks a lot for being with us.
Not a problem. Thank you.
All right. 1-800-892-6477 is the Socrates Exchange number. Max, let's take another one. This is Jenna in Concord. Hi, Jenna. You're on the Socrates Exchange. Go ahead with the question. Why do we punish?
Hi, great show. Thanks for having me.
Good.
I wanted to comment on what you had said earlier about, I think it was a former inmate who said that change could only come when he was ready and wanted to change. I'm a psychotherapist, and I've worked with adolescents in the correction systems for a while now, and I have observed that if a client is lacking the values of the general society, then behavior change had to be based on their personal interests. Motivation could be increased not by appealing to their sense of morals, because either sometimes they don't have them or they're so different than the general society. Rather, you have to appeal to what interests them, namely their freedom.
So what exactly should the criminal justice system be doing then, would you say, when we punish individuals, given your experience?
Well, I've seen the pendulum of justice go from one direction to the other. The people who I'm speaking of, who seemingly lack a moral compass, it is hard to appeal to their morals. And I think that the justice system does a good job at times putting these kids in different programs, taking away their freedoms, then reintroducing them back into society. And sometimes they don't want to do better because they think that they should, but rather they don't want to be punished anymore.
Okay, so I guess what I'm getting at is what's going on here a form of behavioral modification? And if so, how is it happening? Is it that we're changing their values, or we're simply conditioning them in a different way? And then, depending on your answer to that, I wonder, what is it that originally caused them to commit the transgression in the first place? Was it a free choice they made, or simply bad environment, bad upbringing?
Were they hungry? Did they
ignorance,
need food? So
yeah,
they stole
there's
it?
There's all sorts of
there's
possible
that sort
reason.
Of justified crime,
yeah,
so to speak.
Yeah. So let's simplify the question here. What is going on when we are rehabilitating someone? What do you think?
Well, I think that with this population of people who I'm speaking mm-hmm. of, people who are committing crimes because not because of food, but you know, because of whatever reason it is, a social environment. Sometimes their environment is fine, but they still have a value system that's so different from the society at
right.
large that they that society says, no, you can't behave in this way.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, Jenna, thanks a lot.
So yeah, thank you.
Thank
All
you,
right.
Jenna.
Bye-bye. Yeah. And Max, let's take one more. This is Alan waiting in Concord. Alan, thanks for waiting. You're on the Socrates Exchange. On the question, what do you think? Why do we punish?
Thanks for having me, by the way. What I wanted to say was, I was in trouble a lot while I was in high school, and I was incarcerated for a little bit. But I had to. What I think is most important about getting in trouble and punishment is for the person to face what they've done and acceptance in what they have done. And I don't know if that's been addressed enough in this, is that it's not just the punishment at hand that's going to do it. It's the person that is within it that needs to accept it, whether it be through the community, through religion or family. Mm. I mean, when I got in trouble, I know that I had to rely more on my family and from my religion standby to help me get through and figure out what I needed to do to, from there on, to get better, to look better in the community, to make up for what I had done and what I needed to do for to become better.
Wow. Okay, so the suffering or the pain, the deprivation that is imposed in punishment is really an occasion for the person to reflect upon what they've done, come to see that they've done wrong and grow and learn from that. Would that be a fair
assessment? That would be a fair assumption.
Okay. So go ahead.
Well, what I wanted to say was that also the fact that the prison or that punishment is a deterrent is I don't think that that's the best example of what punishment is. I think that deterrent is, I mean, most of the people that go into prison, most of them know what they're going to expect and know that they're going to deal with it and they're going to get out and it's going to be, they're just going to repeat. That's some. Mm-hmm. And then there's the some that accept what has happened to them and they want to change for the better. Mm-hmm. And that's, I don't know, that's kind of where I feel.
Yeah. Okay, so you know that, I guess would you advocate this idea that when parole boards talk to someone who is possibly up for release, that they don't let them go back into society if they see that they haven't learned from what they've done and aren't ready to do that, to live as a free member of society yet? Would you advocate that sort of thing, or flexibility in terms of the sentence, or do you like the idea of a hard and fast sentence?
Well, no, I believe somebody else said earlier about different ways to punish different crimes, where I believe that there are certain lower drug offenses that should be dealt with in a drug court or something of that sort that shouldn't be dealt with in the same place as somebody who just murdered someone or raped someone or something of that sort.
Yeah.
I think that they should be dealt with in different crimes, because when you have a judge who just saw two homicides or an abusive father, what's he going to think when he sees a 16, 17-year-old with a minor marijuana possession charge?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Alan, thank you so much for being with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And Max, I want to thank you very much for being here and let everyone know that you'll be continuing this conversation online later today. So keep your thoughts coming in. Go to the Socrates Exchange page at nhpr.org and continue the discussion with Max. Max, thanks a lot for your time.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure.
That's Max Latona. He's an associate professor of philosophy at St. Anselm College. Now, next time on the Socrates Exchange, we'll ask the question, do we need friendship in an age of friending? We use the term friend in so many ways to refer to so many different kinds of relationships and people. We friend hundreds of people on Facebook. Spouses, children, parents are all supposed to be our friends nowadays. We have BFFs, friends with benefits, and frenemies. So we want to ask how you would define what a friend is, and is that really needed or valued today? How would you define a friend? And when we use the term so widely, do we risk emptying it of all meaning? Just some thoughts to ponder in advance of the next Socrates Exchange. The Exchange and the Socrates Exchange are productions of New Hampshire Public Radio. Funding is provided for the Socrates Exchange in part by the New Hampshire Humanities Council. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our interns are Ryan Lessard and Carrie Feltner. The executive producer of The Exchange and project director of the Socrates Exchange is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org. The Exchange celebrates its 15th anniversary season with support from Bank of America, committed to serving New Hampshire's communities.
What's the latest on legislation at the State House? What does a bill in Washington mean for us in New Hampshire? For answers to the questions important to you, you turn to The Exchange because you get to ask those questions. Your calls and emails have helped us dig into the topic of the day for 15 years. I'm Laura Kanoi. Join me for the next Topic of the Day on The Exchange, weekdays at 9 a.m. here on NHPR.
The Exchange celebrates its 15th anniversary season with support from Bank of America, committed to serving New Hampshire's communities.